What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
97.1 FM Talk.
On demand audio.
Wiggins America.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Wiggins America.
The only thing I'm going to need from you guys right now is a cup of coffee.
Wiggins.
Today's global economy waits for no man.
America.
Today's global business climate is like, whatever, dude.
Hey! Politics is a dirty game. I'm not sure we want to play.
There are forces here at work that you couldn't possibly understand.
You have no idea how high up this goes.
Welcome to Wiggins America.
Old Roy's still here. Hey, you know, one thing we didn't talk about when we were talking about China and the possible collapse of their economy that's happening right now, which if you're just tuning in, get the podcast or rewind or whatever you can do, because this is news that's not being reported. And I'm glad to bring that stuff to you because it's just so, it's kind of in the weed stuff. But, you know, this is why we're here, is to talk about this stuff. But one of the angles that we didn't mention in talking about that, Roy, is that if you have a desperate China, the risk also kind of rises for everybody else, because what if they just decide, you know what, if we're going down, we're going to take everybody down? That's not beyond them, I wouldn't say.
No, I wouldn't put anything past anybody, especially in a dictatorship, communist country like that. My gut would be that rather than take everybody else down, is that they would try desperately to basically take over something else and then live off of that. So I think the threat now, the thing that we talked about with population, it's hurting their military as well, because all the military aged people that they would have had they not had the birth restrictions.
That's very true too.
But they still got some money and they still got weapons, but I would see, before let's just blow everything up and we all go down together, I think there would be a push to invade somebody, whether they come Taiwan. All the way over to here, or Taiwan will be the first, but they could go to take Japan, because we can live off of them for a little while.
That sounds really extreme to me. I mean, I know where you're coming from, because a desperate major authoritarian government is capable of a lot of things. I just don't think that I don't know if they're even capable of doing that, because it would be so detrimental to themselves. You know, I mean, these people, even though it's a decline, assuming it's going to happen, that we're going to see this economic collapse in China that looks like it may be starting, those people will still be in charge. So people who love power, they're not going to give up power, even if they're just ruling over ashes, you know? And that would threaten their power if they were to really invade somebody.
Well, I was talking in terms of like a mutually assured destruction scenario.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They wouldn't take themselves out. They'll let their people starve to death. They'll let their entire population, you know, wither away to nothing. Russia almost did that.
Yeah. They continue to do that.
So as long as they can find another place to feed, basically, their power,
they're like locusts.
Let's
go back to domestic here. Let's talk about the U.S. for a second. Between now and, I don't even want to say November anymore, because early voting starts in like August, depending on which state you're in. But let's say between now and then, let's say between now and August or September, do you expect things to stay pretty much the way they are? Or is there going to be some sort of major event that either planned or unplanned? I mean, maybe this is it. Maybe China economically collapsing could be that major event, and the ripples look like we don't know. But if between now and then, it just seems like there's too much at stake to the powers that be for us to not see any major shakeups between now and then, right?
I think so. I think the regardless of what people will say publicly, I have to believe that world leaders, if they're in dire straits with their economies and so forth, or with wars or everything else, a Trump presidency could bring stability because he'll back out of all of that stuff. And it'll just give people time to regroup and reset from a world leader standpoint, world economies.
Well, you're making an interesting point now. What you're saying, I think, is that Trump almost would be the preferred choice of the establishment, the worldwide establishment, because you know what you're getting. And you know that he would basically just come in and everything, because there's so much war. Is that kind of what you're like? There is a lot more war right now than there was 4 years ago.
Right.
And that is not the kind of thing that world leaders are like, yeah, this is good. We love this.
Right.
It happens and then they have to deal with it. But Trump really would stabilize things in that sense.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying.
I think from a foreign policy standpoint, from a global economic standpoint, you know, the people who are out there pitching global warming as a transfer of wealth, they're not going to like it because their free ride is getting taken. But if people are generally concerned about economic stability on a national level or on a global level, then a Trump presidency would bring, because he's going to focus here. Mm-hmm. And try to clean up what's wrong here. And as he did in his first term, there was no wars. Well, I mean, we didn't start any or get involved in any.
I mean, there weren't really any that started in general.
There was.
I mean, there's always little things that pop up here and there, but there wasn't anything like now.
I think in an odd way, like you said, the preference would be for people who even don't care about U.S. domestic policy. Just if you're a country who's really struggling now, a Trump presidency could stabilize not only from a military standpoint, economic standpoint, even a social standpoint, because a lot of these social and cultural things that are spreading around the globe would sort of back down because they would back down here. And I think the U.S., with the woke and the and a lot of that stuff, we're driving that globally.
Yeah, it's really amazing that we
and
do.
And I think if we can calm it down here, it'll calm down in some of these other places and again, give people time, even the elites, even the globalists, give them time to kind of, whoa, wait a minute now, let's regroup and settle things down. So in a lot of ways, I think it's not just good for us. I think it's good for the world.
I mean, the big money people have seen a dramatic, you know, it's weird because in some senses, the value of money has gone down. And so everybody's lost money. But at the same time, when you pump $8 trillion into the economy, into our economy, that doesn't entirely stay here. You know, most of it is intended to. But that money does go, when you pump money into an economy, it really does end up at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Like the big companies are the ones that ended up with the bulk of the printed money. So they really did okay. So I don't know. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it's really hard to predict. And the one thing that I have come away with in the last 10 years is thinking, you know what? You have these global power players that have a lot of influence, but I don't think they control as much as they would like.
Yeah, that's true.
And they definitely don't control the East. You know, these are mostly Western leaders. And when things crop up and pop up, both in Asia and the Middle East, that freaks them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really know what to do with it. So we're talking about wars, or you're talking about economic collapse or whatever. These are things that they don't really have a whole lot of control over, but do shake them up.
True. But I also think that even hardline, economic policy, just a little bit of common sense, it's pretty, I think most people understand, regardless of the selfish inclinations that I want to be richer, it's always better to move existing money than it is to inject new money for an economy. Just make it move from one thing to another. You don't have to add more, the Democrat, the more taxes. I mean, there's people who still argue to the death about that, but it's pretty clear that you will generate more tax revenue by incentivizing
growth,
the existing yeah. money to work,
yeah,
than you will by just printing more money or raising more money. The cash flow issue, if you get out of the way and you let that machine work, that's the part that the people who really have a lot at stake in terms, not their own power and wealth, but just the stake at stake of a country surviving, Greece almost
yeah.
went belly up yeah. after, So things like that, people who have something at stake in these, even if you're an outside investor in a government, you still want stability. You want movement of the economy at the end of the day. When you get desperate, you've got to go back to what works.
You heard it here first. Old Roy said Trump is the establishment pick, and therefore he's going to be the next president of the United States and president of the world. I'm not putting words in his mouth. That's pretty much what he said. We'll take a short break. Nico Moran from Swan Bitcoin is coming up in this hour. Looking forward to that conversation. Stick around.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Okay, before we get to Nico Moran talking about central bank digital currencies, that's next. We're gonna dig. Before we get there, though, a word with Gavin Newsom, who was shopping in Target and spent something like $350 in Target, which I guess is just normal if you're the governor. You got that kind of cash. You got that kind of sling. So he was shopping, and he saw a robbery taking place in Target. Here's the story as told by Gavin Newsom.
Says, sir, you dropped this. And he comes back, picks it up, and keeps walking out. As we're checking out, the woman says, oh, he's just walking out. He didn't pay for that. I said, well, why don't you stop him? She goes, oh, the governor. Swear to God, true story. On my mom's grave. The governor lowered the threshold. There's no accountability. I said, that's just not true.
Okay, so that's not it, though. It's not just that he saw the robbery and that they, you're talking to the governor. She didn't even know. The clerk was talking to the governor, and she blamed the governor. She didn't know. She didn't know she was talking to Gavin Newsom when Gavin Newsom asked her, hey, why didn't anybody stop that guy? She goes, well, it's the governor's fault. That's awesome. There are people suggesting that maybe she did know she was talking to the governor. That's why she did it. It does not appear that that was the case based on what she says next.
He said, well, we don't stop him because of the governor. And then she goes, she looks at me twice, and then she freaks out. She calls everyone over, wants to take photos. I'm like, no, I'm not taking a photo. We're having a conversation. Where's your manager? How are you blaming the governor? And it was, $380 later. And I was like, why am I spending $380? Everyone can walk the hell right out.
So she goes, oh my gosh, I just insulted the governor. I want to get some selfies. And she starts calling everybody over to get selfies. And he goes, no. I want to talk to you. So the part in between there that maybe didn't get pulled in that clip was that he starts telling her stats about theft in California. So she is, They're both witnessing an actual theft. And then he goes, well, why didn't you do anything? And she goes, well, because the governor doesn't enforce anything, because this government doesn't enforce anything. And he says, well, let me tell you about some stats that would prove otherwise. Don't believe your lying eyes that just saw what I also saw. I want you to listen to my stats. It is an amazing exercise in turning off your brain because you're so academic. I'm so smart that I know so many statistics about actual theft in this state, which he says is like 10th in the nation for theft or something. I mean, it's like, it's not even really a braggable point that he makes. But I know so much that I have to lecture you who just saw a crime and probably sees tons of crime, even though you're seeing more of it than I am. Let me tell you what's really going on. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you for your contribution to this target, which just got robbed. Appreciate your time, but what an amazing story. All right, we're going to stop there because we have to go to Nico Moran. Talk about central bank digital currencies and what they are, why we don't want them. Next. 97.1 FM Talk. This is Wiggins America. I've been looking forward to all weekend our conversation with Nico Moran, who has been on the show before. So welcome back, Nico.
Happy to be here, man. Thank you for having me back.
So your time with Swan Bitcoin has been very valuable in explaining a lot of what, you know, this is a big world that we're talking about with finance and the way things are changing and with digital currency in general and Bitcoin. And I, you know, Trump was in the news recently for saying, and lots of other people have said this too, but he, you know, he made some headlines recently saying, if I'm president, we will not allow a central bank digital currency. Now, when he said that, something popped into my mind that I thought, I think I know what that means, but I'm not exactly sure. So that's why I said, let's have Nico Moran from Swan Bitcoin back on to kind of explain, at least in layman's terms, what is a central bank digital currency?
Yeah, so a central bank digital currency is essentially, in my opinion, the government's attempt to maintain control over money. I think they see Bitcoin and the rise of other digital currencies as a threat to their system. And because Bitcoin is fully decentralized, they can't just really, you know, flick the switch. So what they're hoping for is to roll out these central bank digital currencies as quickly as humanly possible for them to be able to maintain the privilege of being able to create money for free that everyone else has to work for. So in the United States, we have multiple different payment platforms, whether it's Venmo, PayPal, Cash App, Zelle. There's so many of them. And one of the arguments from the current administration as to why central bank digital currencies are necessary is to improve the efficiency of payments. I don't know about you, but all those platforms make payments extremely efficient in the United States. The real, in my opinion, the real push for these CBDCs, again, is for the government to continue to try to hope to maintain control or their monopoly on not only the creation of money, but also the flows of money. Think about it this way, because these CBDCs have already been rolled out in mainland China. It would allow the government to essentially turn off your money at a moment's notice. It would allow them to install social controls. And essentially what that means is, let's say you behave badly in the eyes of the government, they could penalize you, right? Your money having an expiration date. There are so many reasons as to why a central bank digital currency is not only necessary, it could lead to so many abuses by government.
Okay, so explain to me, I think I follow you, but what I can't get my head around is that when I spend money now, so much of it is digital that I don't really get the difference between having a digital dollar versus having what this is, a central bank digital currency. Is this a new kind of currency? Because so many things I do are already digital anyway.
So you hit the nail on the head, right? It's like, wait a second, hold on. Like, I don't really have cash. I have, you know, my debit card. I have my account. Like, everything that I do is digital, right? You hit the nail on the head. Where's the necessity for this? But to answer your question directly, essentially, instead of you having a relationship with your bank and your bank is the custodian of your money, you would essentially have a direct account with the Fed itself. You would have a direct account with the government itself. Essentially, the government would be the bank. bank. And, you know, I think history has shown many, many examples as to why that would be a terrible idea. So essentially, that's what it would be. You would have a direct account with the government. You would have a direct account with the central bank, and essentially they would function as your bank. They would function as your custodian. But again, it goes back to my original point. Why is that necessary? I don't really understand why that's necessary. We have efficient payments. We have private companies that are trying to tackle this problem. But my opinion, and this is actually a paper that was released a couple years ago, central bank digital currencies are a response to the adoption of Bitcoin. They're a response to the adoption of alternative platforms that the government doesn't control. The head of the European Central Bank, her name is Christine Lagarde, she calls Bitcoin and alternative currency, she calls them an escape valve. Central bank digital currency is the government's last attempt. It's like their Hail Mary attempt in order to maintain their control and their monopoly over money.
Interesting. Okay, so if Bitcoin comes out and we can say confidently, at least I think, that there is no inflation, or if there is, there's a very, very small sustained inflation with Bitcoin, with new ones being created all the time. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so Bitcoin is a deflationary currency, meaning about every 4 years the supply gets cut in half, meaning the supply that's being mined, the supply that's being actively put onto the market, that supply gets cut in half every 4 years. There's no other asset that offers that. If you compare that to fiat currency, there's an unlimited amount. Really, there's no limit to how much more money they can print, right? There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And because there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin, it creates absolute scarcity. That's why Bitcoin has been the best performing asset of the last 10, 15 years, because it's for the first time in human history, even if people wanted to mine more Bitcoin, get more Bitcoin, they physically couldn't because of the current protocol rules. If you compare that with gold, gold is pretty scarce. But the thing is, if the price of gold rises, the mining of gold also increases with it. If the price of Bitcoin rises, it doesn't matter. The supply stays the same. The amount of Bitcoin being mined, no matter what, gets cut in half every 4 years. And that creates a situation where you have the most scarce asset in human history.
So Nico Moran with Swan Bitcoin is on with us right now. So if you have a dollar or a Japanese yen or a government-controlled even digital currency that they're saying, hey, we get that there's some benefits to Bitcoin, we just want to make that a government version of that. But if they did, it wouldn't be as scarce. They would want to be able to print as much as they could, right?
Governments will never be able to do two things that Bitcoin offers, right? Number one is governments will always want to debase the currency. That's how they pay for the deficit spending. That's how they pay for things they cannot afford with tax revenue alone. So governments will always want to debase currency, and governments will always want to censor. They'll always want to at least try to control the money flows. And those are two things that Bitcoin offers that governments, even if they really wanted to, even if they promised, they could not help themselves but not to do those two things, right? So that's really the key determining factor. And we're heading into a future where people are going to have to pick and choose. And it's a little bit obfuscated right now, but it is getting included in the political discourse. As you know, you've seen Donald Trump mention it. You've seen Ron DeSantis. You've seen Vivek Ramaswamy. You've seen on the other side, you've seen RFK Jr. both mention that not only are CBDCs a terrible idea, but Bitcoin is actually a good idea. So it is being talked about in the political discourse. That will continue to accelerate in the next couple of years. This will be a hot button issue, I guarantee you, by election year 2028. And people are going to have to pick and choose whether they want to use a currency that is deflationary, meaning your purchasing power increases over time, or do they want to use a currency that is inflationary, meaning your purchasing power decreases over time. People have been convinced that for some reason your money has to lose value. That is not true, and that is what Bitcoin proves, And that's why governments are so scared, and that's why they're rolling out these CBDCs as fast as humanly possible.
Man, it's so interesting to stay ahead of the curve on this because, like you said, you know, this is something that the politicians are beginning to address now. You mentioned DeSantis. I was going to say his name, too. Ramaswamy, I didn't even know he had talked about it. RFK Jr., great to hear that he is, too, because I didn't know that. But they're talking about it, but you're right, it's not front and center yet. They're just sort of addressing it, which I guess is good that they are addressing the issue. But like you said, in 2028, maybe even beyond that, this is going to be something that will be affecting everyday consumers should they continue to push for it. Nico, I want to, before we run out of time here, I want to ask you just in general, can you give us an idea of why I've seen personally Bitcoin has risen dramatically in the last few months? It was kind of at a low, and I'm glad to say that I bought. I dabbled in it. I didn't really buy a lot, but I wanted to just buy some to say that I bought some. And I did so at the right time, and now it's gone back up. What is the reason for that?
Yeah, so it's infinity divided by 21 million, right? There's an infinite amount of dollars, but there's only 21 million Bitcoin. So, you know, as long as they continue to print, which they can't help themselves but to do that, you know, this thing's going to go up forever. It's meant to go up forever. And that sounds unbelievable, right? You see, you hear that, you're like, yeah, that sounds kind of weird, right? But just do the math. It's very simple math. Infinity divided by 21 million. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And I'll break it down like this. There's roughly 60 to 70 million millionaires all around the world. If every single one of those millionaires wanted to buy just one Bitcoin, they physically could not buy one. There's not enough for them, right? So this thing is absolutely scarce. It will protect your purchasing power. It is not meant to be traded. It is meant as savings. Bitcoin is savings. So, you know, if you take a portion of your income, whether that's 10%, 20%, whatever you can afford, and you put it aside and you don't touch that thing, you know, Bitcoin will protect your purchasing power, protect your energy, your time, which is currently being stolen from via inflation, via currency debasement.
Nico Moran of Swan Bitcoin, man, I really appreciate your knowledge and your time and for being a resource for us on these topics. How do people find you if they want to connect with you?
Yeah, you could find me on Twitter, or I think it's called X now. You could go to @BitVolt, and you could find me there, and you can hear some more of my thoughts. And thank you so much, Ryan, for having me on the show. It's been great, like always. Appreciate it.
Well, we will continue to connect with you when these issues come up, because I appreciate your knowledge on them. This is Wiggins America. We will be right back. You know, since there's all these questions about whether somebody is eligible to run for office or not, or to be on certain states' ballots, as we're going through constantly, let's talk about the actual Constitution. What does it say about requirements to be the president? Well, it's pretty simple.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
One FM Talk. This is Wiggins America. I've been looking forward to all weekend our conversation with Nico Moran, who has been on the show before. So welcome back, Nico.
Happy to be here, man. Thank you for having me back.
So your time with Swan Bitcoin has been very valuable in explaining a lot of what, you know, this is a big world that we're talking about with finance and the way things are changing and with digital currency in general and Bitcoin. And I, you know, Trump was in the news recently for saying, and lots of other people have said this too, but he, you know, he made some headlines recently saying, if I'm president, we will not allow a central bank digital currency. Now, when he said that, something popped into my mind that I thought, I think I know what that means, but I'm not exactly sure. So that's why I said, let's have Nico Moran from Swan Bitcoin back on to kind of explain, at least in layman's terms, what is a central bank digital currency?
Yeah, so a central bank digital currency is essentially, in my opinion, the government's attempt to maintain control over money. I think they see Bitcoin and the rise of other digital currencies as a threat to their system. And because Bitcoin is fully decentralized, they can't just really, you know, flick the switch. So what they're hoping for is to roll out these central bank digital currencies as quickly as humanly possible for them to be able to maintain the privilege of being able to create money for free that everyone else has to work for. So in the United States, we have multiple different payment platforms, whether it's Venmo, PayPal, Cash App, Zelle. There's so many of them. And one of the arguments from the current administration as to why central bank digital currencies are necessary is to improve the efficiency of payments. I don't know about you, but all those platforms makes payments extremely efficient in the United States. The real, in my opinion, the real push for these CBDCs, again, is for the government to continue to try to hope to maintain control or their monopoly on not only the creation of money, but also the flows of money. Think about it this way, because these CBDCs have already been rolled out in mainland China. It would allow the government to essentially turn off your money at a moment's notice. It would allow them to install social controls. And essentially what that means is, let's say you behave badly in the eyes of the government, they could penalize you, right? Your money having an expiration date. There are so many reasons as to why a central bank digital currency is not only necessary, it could lead to so many abuses by government.
Okay, so explain to me, I think I follow you, but what I can't get my head around is that when I spend money now, so much of it is digital that I don't really get the difference between having a digital dollar versus having what this is, a central bank digital currency. Is this a new kind of currency? Because so many things I do are already digital anyway.
So you hit the nail on the head, right? It's like, wait a second, hold on. Like, I don't really have cash. I have, you know, my debit card. I have my account. Like, everything that I do is digital, right? You hit the nail on the head. Where's the necessity for this? But to answer your question directly, essentially, instead of you having a relationship with your bank and your bank is the custodian of your money, you would essentially have a direct account with the Fed itself. You would have a direct account with the government itself. Essentially, the government would be the bank. And, you know, I think history has shown many, many examples as to why that would be a terrible idea. So essentially, that's what it would be. You would have a direct account with the government. You would have a direct account with the central bank. And essentially, they would function as your bank. They would function as your custodian. But again, it goes back to my original point. Why is that necessary? I don't really understand why that's necessary. We have efficient payments. We have private companies that are trying to tackle this problem. But my opinion, and this is actually a paper that was released a couple years ago, central bank digital currencies are a response to the adoption of Bitcoin. They're a response to the adoption of alternative platforms that the government doesn't control. The head of the European Central Bank, her name is Christine Lagarde, she calls Bitcoin and alternative currency, she calls them an escape valve. Central bank digital currency is the government's last attempt. It's like their Hail Mary attempt in order to maintain their control and their monopoly over money.
Interesting. Okay, so if Bitcoin comes out and we can say confidently, at least I think, that there is no inflation, or if there is, there's a very, very small sustained inflation with Bitcoin, with new ones being created all the time. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so Bitcoin is a deflationary currency, meaning about every 4 years the supply gets cut in half, meaning the supply that's being mined, the supply that's being actively put onto the market, that supply gets cut in half every 4 years. There's no other asset that offers that. If you compare that to fiat currency, there's an unlimited amount. Really, there's no limit to how much more money they can print, right? There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And because there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin, it creates absolute scarcity. That's why Bitcoin has been the best performing asset of the last 10, 15 years, because it's for the first time in human history, even if people wanted to mine more Bitcoin, get more Bitcoin, they physically couldn't because of the current protocol rules. If you compare that with gold is pretty scarce. But the thing is, if the price of gold rises, the mining of gold also increases with it. If the price of Bitcoin rises, it doesn't matter. The supply stays the same. The amount of Bitcoin being mined, no matter what, gets cut in half every 4 years. And that creates a situation where you have the most scarce asset in human history.
So Nico Moran with Swan Bitcoin is on with us right now. So if you have a dollar or a Japanese yen or a government-controlled even digital currency that they're saying, hey, we get that there's some benefits to Bitcoin. We just want to make that a government version of that. But if they did, it wouldn't be as scarce. They would want to be able to print as much as they could, right?
Governments will never be able to do two things that Bitcoin offers, right? Number one is governments will always want to debase the currency. That's how they pay for the deficit spending. That's how they pay for things they cannot afford with tax revenue alone. So governments will always want to debase currency, and governments will always want to censor. They'll always want to at least try to control the money flows. And those are two things that Bitcoin offers that governments, even if they really wanted to, even if they promised, they could not help themselves but not to do those two things, right? So that's really the key determining factor. And we're heading into a future where people are going to have to pick and choose. And it's a little bit obfuscated right now, but it is getting included in the political discourse. As you know, you've seen Donald Trump mention it. You've seen Ron DeSantis. You've seen Vivek Ramaswamy. You've seen on the other side, you've seen RFK Jr. both mention that not only are CBDCs a terrible idea, but Bitcoin is actually a good idea. So it is being talked about in the political discourse. That will continue to accelerate in the next couple of years. This will be a hot button issue, I guarantee you, by election year 2028. And people are going to have to pick and choose whether they want to use a currency that is deflationary, meaning your purchasing power increases over time, or do they want to use a currency that is inflationary, meaning your purchasing power decreases over time. People have been convinced that for some reason your money has to lose value. That is not true, and that is what Bitcoin proves, and that's why governments are so scared, and that's why they're rolling out these CBDCs as fast as humanly possible.
Man, it's so interesting to stay ahead of the curve on this, because like you said, you know, this is something that the politicians are beginning to address now. You mentioned DeSantis. I was going to say his name too. Ramaswamy, I didn't even know he had talked about it. RFK Jr., great to hear that he is too, because I didn't know that. But they're talking about it, but you're right. It's not front and center yet. They're just sort of addressing it, which I guess is good that they are addressing the issue. But like you said, in 2028, maybe even beyond that, this is going to be something that will be affecting everyday consumers should they continue to push for it. Nico, before we run out of time here, I want to ask you just in general, can you give us an idea of why I've seen personally Bitcoin has risen dramatically in the last few months? It was kind of at a low, and I'm glad to say that I bought. I dabbled in it. I didn't really buy a lot, but I wanted to just buy some to say that I bought some. And I did so at the right time, and now it's gone back up. What is the reason for that?
Yeah, so it's infinity divided by 21 million, right? There's an infinite amount of dollars, but there's only 21 million Bitcoin. So, you know, as long as they continue to print, which they can't help themselves but to do that, you know, this thing's going to go up forever. It's meant to go up forever. And that sounds unbelievable, right? You see, you hear that, you're like, yeah, that sounds kind of weird, right? But just do the math. It's very simple math. Infinity divided by 21 million. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And I'll break it down like this. There's roughly 60 to 70 million millionaires all around the world. If every single one of those millionaires wanted to buy just one Bitcoin, they physically could not buy one. There's not enough for them, right? So this thing is absolutely scarce. It will protect your purchasing power. It is not meant to be traded. It is meant as savings. Bitcoin is savings. So you know, if you take a portion of your income, whether that's 10%, 20%, whatever you can afford, and you put it aside and you don't touch that thing, you know, Bitcoin will protect your purchasing power, protect your energy, your time, which is currently being stolen from via inflation, via currency debasement.
Nico Moran of Swan Bitcoin, man, I really appreciate your knowledge and your time and for being a resource for us on these topics. How do people find you if they want to connect with you?
Yeah, you could find me on Twitter, or I think it's called X now. You could go to @BitVolt, and you could find me there, and you can hear some more of my thoughts. And thank you so much, Ryan, for having me on the show. It's been great, like always. Appreciate it.
Well, we will continue to connect with you when these issues come up, because I appreciate your knowledge on them. This is Wiggins America. We will be right back. You know, since there's all these questions about whether somebody is eligible to run for office or not, or to be on certain states' ballots, as we're going through constantly, let's talk about the actual Constitution. What does it say about requirements to be the president? Well, it's pretty simple, and you may have heard some of this already, or all of this. If you're a constitutional expert, I have a feeling that maybe the thing we're going to end on in this segment you may not have heard even. Well, if you're a constitutional expert, you probably have, but most people haven't. What are the requirements to be president? Must be at least 35 years old, okay? Must be a natural-born citizen of the United States. So there's question about what natural-born citizen means, but as it's always been interpreted, it means that you were born in the U.S. Must have lived in the U.S. for 14 years. That's very, very clear. So how is the president elected? Well, in order to be elected president of the United States, a candidate must receive at least 270 electoral votes. This amount is more than half of all the electors in the nation, since the Electoral College consists of 538 electors. In 48 states and in Washington, D.C., who also gets electors, the winner of the statewide vote receives all the electoral votes for the presidency. Maine and Nebraska have a proportional system and assign their electors based on this. Generally speaking, if you watch these things, Nebraska goes all red, Maine goes almost all blue, but that one extra electoral vote can switch to red pretty often. That's why it's kind of actually a big deal that they might try to keep, or they already are trying to keep Trump off the ballot in Maine. Because most of these states, Illinois, California, probably Colorado, these aren't states that Trump was going to win anyway. But Maine, he could have taken electoral vote there. I mean, it's wrong anyway, I'm just saying, as far as the outcome goes. The presidency is not decided by the popular vote of the nation. It's possible to win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College. This occurred in 2016, 2000, and three times in the 1800s. If no candidate, now here's where it gets interesting in 2024, because this could happen if you have a really good third party candidate, RFK, Manchin, one of those two is the only ones that could pull it off. If no candidate receives a majority of the electoral votes, the decision of who becomes president goes to the House of Representatives. Now keep in mind, hang on, before we get there, keep in mind that you'd have to have, you can't just have a third party candidate that does well. You have to have a third-party candidate that actually wins some states. Because as we just said, it's not a proportional system. It's not as if you win Pennsylvania, you get, well, he did okay, he got five electoral votes. No, it's whoever wins the state gets all the electoral votes. So you have to have somebody who's big enough that they could win multiple states for this to happen. So if there's nobody that gets a majority of the electoral votes, as in 270, the decision of who becomes president goes to the House of Representatives. So who controls the House of Representatives is the key. Right now, that's Republicans. But as I've researched this, the article doesn't say this, but as I've researched it, it looks like the House is sworn in before the president. Therefore, it would be whatever the new House is. So in 2024, if Democrats were to take back the House and then there was nobody in charge of the Electoral College or nobody took 270, then Democrats would get to decide and vice versa with Republicans. The House then picks the new president from the top three candidates, while the Senate elects the vice president from the remaining top two candidates. You catching that? The House would pick the president. So let's say it is Trump. But let's say the Democrats still control the Senate. The Senate then elects the vice president from the remaining top two candidates. So let's say it's Trump, Biden, and RFK Jr. The House would pick Trump. The Senate could pick Biden to be the vice president. This scenario actually did happen in 1824 when John Quincy Adams was president. But that's not... Back then, they actually did this pretty often where they'd pick a vice president from the opposite party. That has not happened in recent history. So, who becomes president? Now, here's the one that I said, and if you're not really a constitutional expert, you're probably not going to know this. Who becomes president if the current president is unable to perform his or her duties? The vice president assumes the presidency if the president is unable to perform their duties according to the White House and the Constitution. This can occur for various reasons, including 1, the president's death, 2, the president's resignation, 3, the president's temporary incapacitation, and here's where it gets interesting, or 4, if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet deem the president is no longer able to perform the duties of the presidency. Now, they didn't just come up with those 4 on their own. That's actually a part of the 25th Amendment. The first one, Section 1, is in the case of the president's death. Section 2 is the president's resignation. That's only happened once, Richard Nixon. The 3rd is the president's temporary incapacitation. And it says whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers. Now, this has actually happened in this administration, I believe. It got no notice because I think it lasted maybe a day. President Biden had to go in for a small procedure. Well, during that procedure, which was probably 4 hours, he had written to the Senate and the House, hey, for the time being, for this time that I am going to be under, the vice president shall assume the presidency. I'm reciting that from memory, but I do think that that happened. It was such a blip. And I think maybe that's pretty common if the president has to go under anesthesia or something, that happens. But it happens. And so that's Section 3. If the president knows, hey, I'm going to be incapacitated, here is what's going to happen. That's how it happens. Now, Section 4 is where it gets really interesting. This is if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet deem the president no longer able to perform the duties of the presidency. Now, I'm reading directly from the 25th Amendment here, if you're wondering how this happens, because a lot of people think that what's going to happen is Biden will get enough votes to become the nominee, but then his own cabinet and Kamala Harris, and these are separate entities, by the way, in the 25th Amendment, will both deem him incapable, and then she will take over, and then possibly somebody else, even her, would then assume the position of not only president for that time, but the nominee as well. Now, that doesn't have to be the same person. She could be the president sitting or acting president while they nominate somebody else because the rules are different for nomination versus presidency. But it's very, very interesting because you have to have both the vice president and the majority of the cabinet decide that he is incapacitated. Then they write their intent to the Senate and to the Speaker of the House that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and the vice president immediately assumes the powers and duties of the office as acting president, regardless of whether the president wants to or not. Though, in this case, you would have to have buy-in from Biden. Buy-in from Biden. Because the president could then immediately, even though the vice president has taken over with the majority of the cabinet, the president could immediately go to the president of the Senate, the president pro tempore of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House, and issue his written declaration that no inability exists. And then he would immediately resume the powers and duties of the office. So then what happens? Because now there's a power struggle. So Congress would have to decide, it says within 4 days, by law, whether the president is actually in charge or the vice president is in charge, because you have dueling factions here. So you'd have to have the full buy-in, 2/3 of the Senate and the House of Representatives confirm either way. Well, actually, I think they would have to confirm that the vice president is actually in charge. Because if they didn't get 2/3, it would revert back to the actual president because he was in charge before. So I don't think it's actually possible that they could remove Biden from office and put Vice President Kamala Harris in as president without full buy. I mean, unless he actually has a medical incident, in which case we would all see it. You'd know, okay, he's laid up. He can't talk. You know, he's in a coma or something. Whatever it is, if Biden didn't buy into it, it wouldn't happen. Because you're not going to get two-thirds of the House, at least, nor the Senate, to confirm that he is out when he is the nominee. Because it looks like right now he will be the nominee. I just thought I would share that because a lot of people like to throw that around. That they're going to take him out of office using the 25th Amendment. But it doesn't look like that's possible unless Biden agrees to it, which means Section 4 wouldn't even really happen. It would be Section 3 of the 25th Amendment. And then, of course, if he is agreeing to it, it would just be like resigning, just like anything else. But they can't forcibly remove him, it doesn't look like to me. All right, it's been a show. Thanks for listening. You can get the podcast if you just tune in at the end and you're like, oh, what the heck he's talking about? You want to hear the rest of the show. Get the podcast by typing in Wiggins America. It's in multiple locations. We'll see you next week. You know, since there's all these questions about whether somebody is eligible to run for office or not, or to be on certain states' ballots, as we're going through constantly, let's talk about the actual Constitution. What does it say about requirements to be the president? Well, it's pretty simple, and you may have heard some of this already, or all of this. If you're a constitutional expert, I have a feeling that maybe the thing we're going to end on in this segment you may not have heard, even. Well, if you're a constitutional expert, you probably have, but most people haven't. What are the requirements to be president? Must be at least 35 years old, okay? Must be a natural-born citizen of the United States. So there's question about what natural-born citizen means. But as it's always been interpreted, it means that you were born in the U.S. Must have lived in the U.S. for 14 years. That's very, very clear. So how is the president elected? Well, in order to be elected president of the United States, a candidate must receive at least 270 electoral votes. This amount is more than half of all the electors in the nation, since the Electoral College consists of 538 electors. In 48 states and in Washington, D.C., who also gets electors, the winner of the statewide vote receives all the electoral votes for the presidency. Maine and Nebraska have a proportional system and assign their electors based on this. Generally speaking, if you watch these things, Nebraska goes all red, Maine goes almost all blue, but that one extra electoral vote can switch to red pretty often. That's why it's kind of actually a big deal that they might try to keep, or they already are, trying to keep Trump off the ballot in Maine. Because most of these states, Illinois, California, probably Colorado, these aren't states that Trump was going to win anyway. But Maine, he could have taken an electoral vote there. I mean, it's wrong anyway, I'm just saying, as far as the outcome goes. The presidency is not decided by the popular vote of the nation. It's possible to win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College. This occurred in 2016, 2000, and three times in the 1800s. If no candidate, now here's where it gets interesting in 2024, because this could happen if you have a really good third party candidate, RFK, Manchin, one of those two is the only ones that could pull it off. If no candidate receives a majority of the electoral votes, the decision of who becomes president goes to the House of Representatives. Now keep in mind, hang on, before we get there, keep in mind that you'd have to have, you can't just have a third party candidate that does well. You have to have a third party candidate that actually wins some states. Because as we just said, it's not a proportional system. It's not as if you win Pennsylvania, you get, well, you know, he did okay, he got five electoral votes. No, it's whoever wins the state gets all the electoral votes. So you have to have somebody who's big enough that they could win multiple states for this to happen. So if there's nobody that gets a majority of the electoral votes, as in 270, the decision of who becomes president goes to the House of Representatives. So who controls the House of Representatives is the key. Right now, that's Republicans. But as I've researched this, the article doesn't say this, but as I've researched it, it looks like the House is sworn in before the president. Therefore, it would be whatever the new House is. So in 2024, if Democrats were to take back the House and then there was nobody in charge of the Electoral College or nobody took 270, then Democrats would get to decide and vice versa with Republicans. The House then picks the new president from the top three candidates, while the Senate elects the vice president from the remaining top two candidates. You catching that? The House would pick the president. So let's say it is Trump. But let's say the Democrats still control the Senate. The Senate then elects the vice president from the remaining top two candidates. So let's say it's Trump, Biden, and RFK Jr. The House would pick Trump. The Senate could pick Biden to be the vice president. This scenario actually did happen in 1824 when John Quincy Adams was president. But that's not... Back then, they actually did this pretty often where they'd pick a vice president from the opposite party. That has not happened in recent history. So, who becomes president? Now, here's the one that I said, and if you're not really a constitutional expert, you're probably not going to know this. Who becomes president if the current president is unable to perform his or her duties? The vice president assumes the presidency if the president is unable to perform their duties, according to the White House and the Constitution. This can occur for various reasons, including 1, the president's death, 2, the president's resignation, 3, the president's temporary incapacitation, and here's where it gets interesting, or 4, if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet deem the president is no longer able to perform the duties of the presidency. Now, they didn't just come up with those 4 on their own. That's actually a part of the 25th Amendment. The first one, Section 1, is in the case of the president's death. Section 2 is the president's resignation. That's only happened once, Richard Nixon. The third is the president's temporary incapacitation. And it says whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers. Now, this has actually happened in this administration, I believe. It got no notice because I think it lasted maybe a day. President Biden had to go in for a small procedure. Well, during that procedure, which was probably 4 hours, he had written to the Senate and the House, hey, for the time being, for this time that I am going to be under, the vice president shall assume the presidency. I'm reciting that from memory, but I do think that that happened. It was such a blip. And I think maybe that's pretty common if the president has to go under anesthesia or something, that happens. But it happens. And so that's Section 3. If the president knows, hey, I'm going to be incapacitated, here is what's going to happen. That's how it happens. Now, Section 4 is where it gets really interesting. This is if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet deem the president no longer able to perform the duties of the presidency. Now, I'm reading directly from the 25th Amendment here, if you're wondering how this happens, because a lot of people think that what's going to happen is Biden will get enough votes to become the nominee, but then his own cabinet and Kamala Harris, and these are separate entities, by the way, in the 25th Amendment, will both deem him incapable, and then she will take over, and then possibly somebody else, even her, would then assume the position of not only president for that time, but the nominee as well. Now, that doesn't have to be the same person. She could be the president sitting or acting president while they nominate somebody else because the rules are different for nomination versus presidency. But it's very, very interesting because you have to have both the vice president and the majority of the cabinet decide that he is incapacitated. Then they write their intent to the Senate and to the Speaker of the House that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and the vice president immediately assumes the powers and duties of the office as acting president, regardless of whether the president wants to or not. Though, in this case, you would have to have buy-in from Biden. Because the president could then immediately, even though the vice president has taken over with the majority of the cabinet, the president could immediately go to the president of the Senate, the president pro tempore of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House, and issue his written declaration that no inability exists. And then he would immediately resume the powers and duties of the office. So then what happens? Because now there's a power struggle. So Congress would have to decide, it says within 4 days, by law, whether the president is actually in charge or the vice president is in charge, because you have dueling factions here. So you'd have to have the full buy-in, two-thirds of the Senate and the House of Representatives confirm either way. Well, actually, I think they would have to confirm that the vice president is actually in charge. Because if they didn't get two-thirds, it would revert back to the actual president because he was in charge before. So I don't think it's actually possible that they could remove Biden from office and put Vice President Kamala Harris in as president without full buy. I mean, unless he actually has a medical incident, in which case we would all see it. You'd know, okay, he's laid up. He can't talk. You know, he's in a coma or something. Whatever it is, if Biden didn't buy into it, it wouldn't happen. Because you're not going to get two-thirds of the House, at least, nor the Senate, to confirm that he is out when he is the nominee. Because it looks like right now he will be the nominee. I just thought I would share that, because a lot of people like to throw that around. That they're going to take him out of office using the 25th Amendment. But it doesn't look like that's possible unless Biden agrees to it, which means Section 4 wouldn't even really happen. It would be Section 3 of the 25th Amendment. And then, of course, if he is agreeing to it, it would just be like resigning, just like anything else. But they can't forcibly remove him, it doesn't look like to me. All right, it's been a show. Thanks for listening. You can get the podcast if you just tune in at the end and you're like, oh, what the heck he's talking about? You want to hear the rest of the show. Get the podcast by typing in Wiggins America. It's in multiple locations. We'll see you next week.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.